Welcome to the Zweigletter Podcast, putting architectural, engineering, planning, and environmental consulting advice and guidance in your ear. Zweig Group's team of experts have spent more than three decades elevating the industry by helping AEP and environmental consulting firms thrive. And these podcasts deliver invaluable management, industry, client, marketing, and HR advice directly to you, free of charge. The Zweigletter Podcasts, elevating the design industry one episode at a time.
Hey, folks, and welcome back to another episode of the Zweigletter Podcast. I'm your host, Randy Wilburn. I'm excited to be with you today. As always, I've got a great episode for you. I have Scott Erickson from E2 Engineers with us today. And Scott is somebody that I connected with through Chad Kleinens, the CEO and president of Zweig Group. And Chad thought it would be great to have Scott on to, you know, talk about some of the opportunities and challenges that smaller design firms face in the era of consolidation, in the era of just, you know, there's a lot of companies out there, and there's a lot of interesting things happening in the design industry face. And this is in the design industry space. And so I thought it would be interesting to have Scott on and to talk about kind of some of his experiences, you know, starting up and growing a smaller design firm. He's based up in the Connecticut marketplace. He serves Connecticut, Massachusetts, I believe Rhode Island, and a few of the other New England states and beyond. And he's doing some really interesting work up there. And so without further ado, I want to welcome Scott Erickson to the Zweigletter Podcast. Scott, how are you doing today?
Good. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, man, listen, I know we had a chance to speak a little bit about this when I think maybe last month we talked a little bit about it. But for those, I know I gave you a little bit of a preview, but for those that don't know you or know anything about E2, would you just give us your superhero origin story into the engineering space? And then we'll kind of carry the conversation from there.
Sure. I'm Scott Erickson, principal and founding owner of E2 Engineers. We're based out in London, Connecticut. We also have an office in Concord, Massachusetts. We're a firm of 18 people, private consulting engineering firm working 99.99% in the building space. Started the firm in 2003, and we have steadily grown it. Took on a partner in 2010, Chad Vogt. And then in 2021, we elevated three people to associate principal, Kate, Jeff, and Mac. And we've steadily grown. But we have seen a dynamic shift since post-COVID. It started during COVID, and it's continued after COVID, where there is an absolute all-out war on talent. And the smaller firms such as ourselves, I don't want to say we're getting marginalized in acquiring that talent, but we're getting marginalized trying to acquire that talent and to hold on to it. You know, we've had instances where we've had interns with us for a couple summers. We hire them full-time. You know, we coach them up and get them to somewhere where they're starting to really be productive for us and get some traction in the engineering world. And then a large national firm offers them way more than we can afford to pay them, you know, above and beyond the market space value. And we lose them. And this has happened to us a couple times now. And you know, for an 18-person firm to go through that, it's a challenge. The other thing we're seeing around us is the mergers and acquisitions. We've had two of our competitors recently in the last couple of years be acquired by larger firms. We've been approached by larger firms ourselves. And, you know, we're trying to resist that. We're trying to actually grow via acquisitions. But again, that's really, really a struggle for a firm our size, given the war chest of some of these other companies who can come in and grab firms a little bit smaller than us, but they can go in and readily grab those firms more easily than we can.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the way you share this, it's almost as if it's a fait accompli, right? It's like this is like the inevitability of this industry. But I don't know that I necessarily believe that. I mean, consolidation happens in a lot of different verticals and a lot of different markets. I think the challenge, like you said, is the biggest issue is the war on talent. How do we find and keep the best people? And the other challenge that we're facing that, again, it's you struggle with this as well as larger firms, is that they're not printing enough degrees in engineering. They're not printing enough degrees in architecture. And those are some of the issues that, as a whole, the whole industry actually has to step back and take a look at that and see whether or not we're doing everything in our power to educate the marketplace and primarily educate the young kids, if you will, that this is a great opportunity, that moving into the design industry space, being a responsible or a part of the built environment, really is a great career arc to consider. And that too is an issue or a challenge that we're facing right now.
I'm glad you touched on that, because it's a huge issue. If you look at engineering schools across the country, enrollment's down. And listen, engineering school's tough. You know, those first couple of years of engineering school are a litmus test. And nowadays you can get into the market space and work another job, entry level, and get just as much as an engineer and not have to go through engineering school. I mean, business schools basically exist in colleges because they're full of engineering students after the first couple of years who shifted over. So you're absolutely right. We are not stressing STEM enough. You know, math, science, technology, we're not stressing enough at the grassroots level, which is your junior high and your high schools, and getting them interested in engineering, architecture, building. You know, they don't have to come work for an engineering firm like mine, but they can. I'd like to see them go work for a contractor, go work for an architect, or go work for an MEP engineer or something like that. You know, let alone the trades. I don't even want to go into there. But you know, you hit the nail on the head. The engineering schools are looking for talent themselves, and you know, it's a struggle across the board to fill that void.
Yeah. I mean, again, like I said, I don't know that there's any specifically right answer as far as that's concerned. You know, I'd be curious to know, based on what you just shared around some of the talent that you've lost to bigger firms, do you keep in touch with any of those people by any chance? Do you just kind of leave the light on for them, if you will, in terms of possibilities of returning? Because sometimes, and here's the thing, and Scott, you know this, I mean, we both have a little gray hair in our heads, so we understand that, you know, it's not, the grass is not always greener on the other side of the block. And sometimes it perceives to be green, but then once you actually get up close and personal, it loses its luster and its shine. I'd be curious to know what type of interactions you might have with some of those that you've lost, because this is something that I constantly tell other firms, that even if you lose somebody to a competitor or just for whatever reason, just stay in touch with them. Keep the lines of communication open, because in this day and age of technology and what allows us to work wherever we are, you know, there's always a possibility of, as I like to think of, a boomerang employee coming back to the nest, if you will. And so I'd be curious to know what some of your interactions have been like from that perspective, because I get it that some people are like, oh, if you leave me, you're dead to me. And I'm like, I don't think that's the best route to take. Yeah.
It's interesting you bring that up. We had, and a little tie-in to Zweig here, we had an engineer leave us the beginning of summer last year, senior engineer, great worker, you know, great for the office culture, was a horse of an engineer. Whatever you gave him, he just did it. He did it well. And he got an offer from a firm and thought, you know, let me go see if the grass is greener on the other side. And I'm at the Zweig event, the AEC Elevate, and my phone rings. I look down and it's him. And I pick it up and I said, hey, you ready to come back? He goes, well, actually, I might. So we always kept the lines of communication open. You know, I don't think we've had many engineers leave here burning a bridge. I mean, you know, some people handle it better than others. But, you know, we've had even the engineers who worked here in the past, you know, there's a reason why we were rated the number one structural engineering firm in the country overall and for our size. Is we believe 1,000% in we invest 1,000% in our people. And it's very, very important to us, our office culture. So even the people who have left, they were good, good people, good, good engineers. Some of them were great engineers. And it just, the dynamics of a small firm don't fit everyone. And some people did want to see if the grass was greener. And it's funny, some of those people have bounced around quite a bit since they left me too.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just a sign of the times, I think.
I think so. Yeah. Because I know back in the 90s when I first got introduced to this industry, you know, back then, you know, hiring managers would be like, hey, if you leave me, you're dead to me, right? I mean, that's just the way that they would take the approach. They would be like, you know what, I don't want to see you ever again. But nowadays, I don't think we can, you know, we can take that tact. And I mean, you said it very well. I mean, you guys are a best firm to work for. You guys just won that award this past year. And that speaks volumes for the amount of time and effort that you put into growing the culture at E2 based on the kind of work that you want to do. I'd be curious to know, how are you finding it in terms of meeting the needs of your clients? And I mean, theoretically, I guess if I came to you tomorrow with five structural engineers, you know, that could hold their own, you'd probably figure out a way to hire all five of them. Is that correct?
I would hire all five. And I'll tell you why. It's easier to find work in this industry than it is to find employees. And I've always had that mindset. And E2's always had that mindset. We've hired people. If they fit, we hire them, period. I don't care if people are sitting around, you know, drafting details because we have no work. Eventually, the work will be there. And eventually, we're going to need that engineer. So yes, if talent becomes available, we will snatch it up. And I think the other thing that's changed in this industry as well, and kind of learned this lesson a little bit last week, is you got to act quick. You know, there's these engineers, this talent is that's out there are getting multiple offers. And, you know, the time is of the essence. You got to strike quick.
Yeah. I mean, that's so true. You can't wait around and, you know, let them think about it or shop an offer around to several firms. And I see that a lot, typically with larger firms that just have, it's just a much more involved process to move things around. I mean, you guys at your size at E2, I mean, I'm sure you can be a little bit more nimble about how you approach the hiring process and what you do. The other thing that we talked about on our previous phone call was, you know, possibly getting a little bit more creative about how you reach out and connect with the next generation of engineers or the next generation of design professionals. And I shared with you a story about working with a client while I was employed at Zweig, where I made some introductions with them with Clemson University. Clemson has an amazing structural engineering program, but they're not the only ones. There are several out there. And I have always found that a lot of times, if you insert whatever expertise your firm offers, think about the fact that there are probably four or five universities that produce that kind of talent, that have that kind of, they do that kind of studying and rigor and skill in those specific areas of expertise within the design industry. And, you know, you need to know what those schools are. You should know the professors at some of those schools to start connecting with the next generation of talent that's coming out of there. And it's kind of like, you know, I don't know, Google recruiting the top tech folks out of MIT or the top tech folks out of Cal Poly or someplace like that. You know, you have to be a little bit more creative, and it sounds like a lot of work, and it might be, but I mean, you'd kind of have to go where the opportunities exist, as opposed to hoping that these folks just end up at your doorstep with their hand raised saying, hey, I'm looking, you know, and
I think you're absolutely right. You can't sit around and wait. We're going to have to become more proactive, and we've started that already. You know, our Concord office is positioned pretty well, just outside of Boston. And there's a handful of engineering schools to draw upon from there. And then we have a relationship with two schools up there that, you know, feed us resumes, and, you know, we go through their process. And we're doing the same thing here in Connecticut. There's a few engineering schools in Connecticut that are good. And we're trying to foster those relationships as well. But I think you're right. Our intern program is really, really key. So like I said before, when we lose people that came through the intern program, it's even a little bit more of a shock to the system because, you know, they've been with you for a little bit longer, even though their resume says they've only been working with you for 2 years. Well, they've really been there for four. You know, they've been there for, you know, two summers. A lot of our interns come back during Christmas break to earn a little cash. So even during that 1 month, you know, if they're local, you know, we offer it to them. Like, hey, come on in. You know, we're running a skeleton staff during that month anyway. We could always use a body to Revit work or, you know, whatever. And so you're absolutely right. The industry as a whole has to get more involved with the high school level and the college level, especially the smaller firms. The smaller firms, have got to start positioning themselves within these institutions so that you can develop a steady stream of engineering candidates. And you got to realize you're going to lose some of those candidates because we've seen it now, right? We've seen that you're going to bring them in, you're going to coach them up, and then you're going to lose some. There's going to be that attrition. It's just the way the world is. The days of me when I got out of college and staying with a firm for 5 years and then 6 years, and then, you know, but those are gone. You know, they're told on the internet, the only way you make money is to change jobs. I mean, recruiters are telling them the same thing. Yeah. So that's just a fact of life that we're dealing with now. And it affects culture. It affects your production. It affects your bottom line. So the sooner you can dial that all in and deal with those, you know, intricacies of the business now, better off you're going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I wonder, as I'm hearing you talk, I wonder what have you run across from a potential acquisition standpoint, or what has been kind of like the factor that has not allowed you to kind of make an acquisition or a merger, if you will? Because I can imagine that, and I've talked to other firms that are like your footprint or maybe just a little bit larger or maybe just a little bit smaller. And there seems to be some way to get like-minded firms that have very similar characteristics to kind of come together and work together, right? As opposed to being subsumed by a much larger company where you really theoretically could lose your identity when that happens, right? Because I could see another firm coming up alongside of you that's 20 people and you guys are 20 people. And it's like all of a sudden you guys are 40. That's not big, but it would be big for you. And at the same time, you don't necessarily run into the issue of potentially losing your identity in the process.
Interesting. So I started going to M&A conferences about almost 2 years ago. And I think I was at my first one for 5 minutes. I was like, we got to do this. I mean, this is the way to grow. We've tried organically and it's just not working. We're losing people faster than we can get them in the door. And so, you know, we engaged Zweig and we did some kicking of the tires and looked at possibilities. And then internally, we kind of took a step back and said, okay, we do feel like this is the way for us to grow in the future. But we need to do X, Y, Z to get ready for that. And we are doing that now. We are in the process of, you know, stacking up a war chest, having some extra cash on hand than we normally would for something like that. And then I think we'll dip our feet back into the cycle and see what's available. I think we're definitely looking outside the Northeast corridor. It would be something, you know, in the South or in the Midwest or in the, you know, mountain regions, all the areas that obviously are growing faster than the Northeast and also have a plethora of talent. You know, the talent is leaving the Northeast for these locales. So I definitely think it's something that we're going to do and we need to do, but we need to take some steps internally before we can do it.
Yeah. 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 And I would imagine too, though, you know, as you're kind of on dual channels of working this angle, you still have to serve the needs of your current clients, right? And that's always, a real, I mean, not a challenge, but you always want to continue to remain as relevant and as viable with your client. Do you find that it's easier for you to serve the needs of your clients given your size versus a much larger firm that sometimes things can get lost in translation just because you're dealing with so many different levels and layers?
It's interesting. A lot of the architects we work for, that's the primary client base for us as architects, are like size. Some are smaller, but some are larger. And most of those larger architectural firms don't normally work with larger structural engineering firms than us. We're one of the larger structural engineering firms in Connecticut, believe it or not. And so we typically work with clients our size or a little bit larger. You know, as far as whether or not we serve better than larger firms, I really can't speak on that. I never worked at a large firm. I've always worked at small size firms. But I do think there's a level of, I don't want to say intimacy, but I think the personal relationships between, you know, a smaller firm like us and a like-minded firm or like-sized firm on the architecture side or MEP side, because we do work with them quite a bit, you develop those relationships and it's easy. You know, it's, you know, I'm going to send this RFP to Scott and get a price from him and we'll use that. I don't know if that normally happens on the larger side. It could, it should, but I can't speak to that. I only know this side of the arena.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And again, I've heard from different ones and, you know, it's, I think there are opportunities that exist there on both sides of the coin. I just think that when you think about a smaller firm and just the, there's not as many layers of bureaucracy. There's not as many people to have to go through to get something done. Sometimes it just lends itself to smaller entities having a much better time getting something accomplished in a quick time frame too, right? Because a lot of times clients, whenever they come to you with a plan, they want it tomorrow. And it's like, yeah. Well, how do you deliver that quickly? So, and can you get up to speed and give the client what they want?
Internally. Our workload is constantly juggled internally. It's, you know, we'll have a deadline over here of a large school, you know, on Friday, and we'll be like, okay, so what's so-and-so working on over here? And when's his deadline? Oh, it's not for 2 weeks. All right, let's pull him off for a couple of days, have him help out for this deadline. Mm-hmm. And then that person will help him out when it's time for their deadline. And I do think being small like that is more advantageous because it allows you, like you said earlier, to be nimble and to, you know, shift the dynamics around the office rather quickly and say, okay, you know, you're working with him for a couple of days. You guys got to get this accomplished. And they do, you know, and the person who is looking for help is like, thank you. And the person who is helping knows that they're going to get help down the road. So they're like, okay, thank you. So yeah, in that regard, I definitely think smaller firms have an advantage where, you know, there's not go to him and see if it's okay. They shoot us a message on Slack. So say they need help, and within 15 minutes we arrange help, and it's done.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and that gives a whole new meaning to resource allocation. Mm-hmm. So it definitely does help. Are you doing anything right now? Are you using any tools that you have found to be truly a game changer? You mentioned Slack, and I know there's all kinds of stuff out there, and AI is actually playing a role in how we do some things. I'd be curious to know if you have incorporated that in any way, shape, or form, or have found that to be a benefit for your overall workflow at E2.
So I am attending a symposium in Atlanta that's going to have some AI portion to it, as well as the small business.
That's a shameless plug, but we appreciate it.
And it's going to have some small business roundtables and whatnot. I'm interested to learn what AI can do for us. You know, I hear a lot of talk about how AI is really geared towards helping smaller firms who take advantage of AI could really leverage the power of AI faster than a larger firm. And I'm interested to hear how that works. You know, you hear a lot of talk about how AI is going to make your life better. Show me. You know what I mean? I need someone to just show me how it's going to do so. And yeah, we're always willing to try. We were one of the first firms to hop on Revit, and it changed us. You know, us hopping on Revit early, you know, several years before some of our competitors, literally opened our doors to projects that we never had access to before. So, and it was because we were doing Revit. So same thing with AI. If there's something out there that we can leverage and gives us a competitive advantage, makes our lives a little bit easier, and allows us to manage the business more seamlessly, yes, sign me up.
Yeah. No, I think it's definitely going to be a game changer for a lot of people. And I mean, we're already seeing a ton of different applications. I suspect that event that you're attending in Atlanta in May is going to be not so much. Well, yeah, I think it will be an eye opener. I think from a best practice standpoint, when you hear what some of the other companies are out there doing, some of your peer firms are doing with AI, you're going to want to figure out how you can adopt that into your current workflow. Because I think it will save a lot of time. And, you know, and I always think of just simple stuff like, you know, RFPs and answering those. And, you know, what's the best RFP that you've answered in the last 2 years? Well, here's the model of what that looks like. So then you teach AI that as you're creating a new one, I want you to take elements of this and utilize it in this RFP that we're doing. And then you explain it to it. And, you know, it creates a pretty reasonable facsimile of what you need or what you're looking for. And then whoever typically spends 15 to 20 hours on this RFP now is spending 5. And then that resource can be utilized in a different way. And that, to me, those are like the little ways. And there are others, of course, but those are some of the small ways that you can reallocate. And especially if a firm your size, when you can take 10 to 15 hours of time off of somebody's plate and transfer to just five, that's a win-win in my book.
I agree. I definitely think on the clerical side, some of the stuff that we do, the mundane stuff that we do, which is mostly what I do nowadays, which is RFPs, proposals, and you know, I still review all the projects that I do, but for the most part, that's the world I'm in now. It's sales and managing clients. And yes, it would be great to not keep doing the cut and paste and doing all that stuff that you do for all these submissions. So yes. The other thing I'm interested to see happen is, what does Autodesk do with AI? You know, so yeah. There was this whole thing about Revit, how it's going to make lives easier for architects and engineers. Never did. I mean, yeah, building coordination is way better. I give you that. But, you know, it's not like they're spending less time doing it than they were in CAD. They're probably spending more time because, you know, you have certain levels of development you need to achieve on these Revit models. It'd be great to see AI somehow integrated into Revit to take out some of the mundane tasks that even people who are doing their own Revit models do, you know, on a daily basis, typical details, sections, you know, annotation, stuff like that. It'd be great for it to truly, truly be something smart where, you know, if you put something in, you model it, it annotates it, everything. It does everything for you. You don't have to manipulate it whatsoever. So I'm hoping someday that something like that happens, because I'd like to get engineers back to doing what they like to do, which is designing buildings instead of trying to manipulate a 3D model.
Yeah. No, I mean, even just in that example that you gave, I'm sure we're probably no more than 18 months to 2 years away from something like that, if it doesn't already exist and they're just kind of fine tuning it right now. So that's kind of the hope of AI, but it definitely is going to present a whole different option. And honestly, that's going to probably allow you to take on more work than you normally could just because you have the ability to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think most people who work at small engineering firms like ours are designers. They like to design. I know all the engineers that we have really, really take their designing. That's the most sacred part of what they do. And I'd like to get engineers back to designing instead of, you know, manipulating a 3D model to make sure it's perfect for the architect, perfect for the mechanical engineer. Oh, by the way, perfect for the contractor who is now manipulating it for their needs and purposes. So yeah, hopefully that comes to fruition.
Yeah. So tell me this, and I'd be curious to know, we didn't bring this up, but have you ended up hiring anybody that's working remote for you, or are you in a position if someone were to come up and say, yeah, I want to work with you, but you know, I'm taking care of my mom or dad, or they're getting up in age and I can't move from South Jersey, but I want to work with you. And they're a talented structural engineer. Is that something that you're willing to take on? Are you in a position to bring on somebody with that skill set and ability, even if they are working remotely? Because I think a lot of people are still, I mean, what is it? The back to work movement has started, right? And everybody's like, hey, let's get back to the office. Let's all see each other. Be kneecap to kneecap again. But then there are some people that just can't do that for a variety of reasons. But are you are you currently doing that right now with any of your staff? And B, are you in a position where you can bring somebody on and they can work remotely?
Great question. And I agree with you. You know, this all started in COVID.
Yeah.
It's a funny story. Give me a few minutes to go into this, but we were doing employee reviews. I think it was the beginning of 2020. So it was just before COVID. Mm-hmm. And we're doing employee reviews. And we had one of our senior engineers who's no longer with us, great engineer, ask us, you know, have you considered going, you know, part-time remote? Like, no, why would we consider that? And it's like, oh, it's the way of the future. And we were like, yeah, no, it doesn't fit what we do. Fast forward 3 months, the country's locked down, everyone's remote, right? So during COVID, we did hire remote engineers. We had a spike, just like a lot of firms like ours. We had a spike in business and we needed engineers and we hired a couple of remote engineers. Fast forward to COVID ending and we did start the movement of bringing engineers back to the office. And a lot of the attrition that we saw due to that was due to the fact that we had engineers go home and they decided they liked working from home better. And it created a tension when we all came back in the office of between the people who didn't want to be there And I'm not saying they didn't want to be employees of our firm, but they didn't want to be in the office. They firmly believed that they were better off at home. The benefits of being at home suited them. And so none of those people are with us anymore. And we are, our current office is 3 days in, 2 days out. So we are hiring. We do have one remote engineer. He lives in New Hampshire. And one of the reasons why we hired him is he has a skill set that we were seeking, which is historical preservation and historical structural engineering. And we knew him. We had known him for years in the industry. And it was a good fit. So yes, we do have one remote engineer. We would entertain more remote engineers given their talent skill set. You know, one of the things we learned during COVID, and I'm sure most firms learned this, is the younger engineers who don't have a lot of experience, wow, them being home by themselves and during COVID did not serve them well. I mean, we had internal communications already set up. We were using Slack. I think we started that in 2017. So we were using that internally for 3 years before we got sent home for COVID. So we already had that communication platform in place and we were utilizing it, but they really went home and floundered. Some of them regressed, which is, you know, not to no fault of their own. So I think it would depend on the engineer. You know, I think a lot of our seniors went home and flourished because no one was bothering them. There's no staff engineers tapping them on the shoulder. Can you show me this? Can you show me that? So they went home and they just pounded out work. So I think it depends on the level of engineer, what kind of self-starter they are. You know, I get up out of bed every day with a purpose. And I think someone who stays home every day and works remotely needs to do the same. They, you know, they got to get up, make their bed, put on some real clothes and, you know, act like it's a business day. They can't be wearing pajama bottoms and not showering and stuff like that. You could fall into that trap pretty quickly. But I think if you treat it as a professional job, just like anything else, then it can work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think the verdict is still out. And I don't know that it's so much a verdict as it is just firms learning how to properly implement remote work and how you engage people even when they aren't physically in your sight lines, right? Because I mean, there are ways to do that. And it's just, how do we in the design industry space leverage the knowledge that we have to keep our folks engaged at all times, whether they are within an arm's reach of us or whether they are halfway across the country? I think that is a challenge that we have that can be met just by virtue of the technology that exists to keep people engaged and keep them educated and up to date on the latest changes. I think the biggest issue in this space, and I'm kind of switching gears now, is the transfer of knowledge, right? And historically in our space for design professionals, the transfer of knowledge has happened kneecap to kneecap. Like you said, a senior designer looking over the shoulder of that young engineer, that young architect, kind of walking them through the process. And yeah, remote work doesn't necessarily lend itself to that, but there are ways that companies can effectively work on transferring that knowledge, making sure that as some of us get older and grayer, that before we exit the industry, we kind of share that information that we have, that institutional knowledge that we've had over the years. That to me is a major challenge that the design industry is facing because we're not getting any younger collectively. And we have to figure out ways to make sure that whatever my 35 years are on the job, if that were the case, that doesn't just go with me into retirement or into the sunset, or if I die to the graveyard, right? I think it's important for us to continue to transfer that knowledge.
I am a firm believer that us advanced age engineers or designers, I'll call it, owe it to the younger generation to pay it forward and take them under your wing and give them guidance and show them the ropes. Someone did it for me. Someone did it for all my partners. And, you know, we've done it for years here at E2 Engineers. It's a duty for you to do that. And it's enjoyable. I mean, there's nothing like seeing a young engineer finally get it. You know, it's funny, those engineers come out of school, the younger ones, and they quickly learn within 6 months that after 4 years of school, oh my God, they know nothing. And we tell them that all the time. When we're interviewing, we assume you know nothing. But what we do know is that you went through 4 years of engineering school and you can learn it. So we know you have the aptitude. We know you have the drive. We know you have the determination to see something through. That's all we need. we can take the rest. We can handle the rest. You know, you, as long as you keep those traits going, you're going to learn and you're going to prosper in this industry. So
yeah.
Yeah, we owe it to the younger generations. And you know, that's one of the problems we ran into post-COVID. In talking to some of our senior engineers who didn't want to come back, they were like, well, I don't want to come back. Well, you kind of owe it to the younger engineers to, you know, foster them and guide them along. And some of them didn't want to do it. So
Move on.
You find the ones that will.
Yeah, it's tough. I think, you know, my thing is, too, you have to model that, right, with the older design professionals. If they model that, then the younger ones kind of see that and they see the benefit of it. Plus, I think, you know, when you learn something and you effectively, the best way to know that you know it is to teach it. It's to show somebody else that, hey, I understand this and I want to do that. So even the younger folks, you know, the 4 and 5 year in engineers that are 4 and 5 years out of school can help those just, you know, wet behind the ears engineers that have just graduated. You know, they can help as well. So, I mean, it's an ongoing process. I just think this industry needs to be extremely intentional about promoting that type of transfer of knowledge and encouraging everybody that it's all of us have a part to play in this. And it's not, oh, that's just the senior leadership. They have to figure that out. I'm just here to draw my drawings and do what I have to do. No, everybody has to carry a little bit of that weight. Because again, as I say all the time, and I shared this with you on our last call, is that a lot of times I think design professionals don't always appreciate the level of standing that they have in our society as being responsible for the built environment. And, you know, I'm going to keep repeating that as long as I'm involved with the design industry, because I think it's just a healthy reminder that what the work that you do, you personally, Scott, and as well as your team and everybody else in this space, the work that you do really, really does matter. And there's never room for rounding errors. There's never room for, oh, I messed that design up, even though that building's already been built. These are things that you never want to hear out of an engineer's mouth or an architect's mouth for that matter. So, I mean, I say all that to say is that, yeah, I recognize that the stakes are high, but you guys are responsible for the built environment. And, you know, you have a heavy mantle on you. And I certainly want to do everything I can to help this industry continue to succeed, because it speaks to how we grow as a society.
Well, I appreciate you bringing our struggle to the forefront and what we go through every day. It is interesting because I honestly never think of that. You know, I never sit there and think, oh my God, we're responsible for so many things. It's just our job. It's what we're used to. So, but thank you. And there's no such thing as good enough. Well, when we're doing stuff,
right.
No. And we're pretty intentional. And I like your use of the word earlier. I think intention is a great word that people need to focus on. We intentionally review our structural designs internally ad nauseum, especially some of the larger structures that we do. You know, they all get a standard of care that is, you know, warranted. But you're right. It's a burden that we carry and we take it seriously.
Yeah. I mean, listen, this will be the last story I tell. I recently, I'm the president of my POA, and we redid our pool deck, and our pool sits on a hill, and we had to do some geotechnical work. You know, everybody was concerned that the pool was going to slide down the hill onto the next block. And, you know, the geotechnical engineers looked at everything. They really did research and said, hey, this is standing on a certain type of rock. That pool's not going anywhere, but here is the issue. The deck that is currently supporting that pool was not built properly. So we actually had a structural engineer, an SE, come in and re-engineer that deck properly to the point where all the pylons are going down to like 16 feet down to where it hit bedrock. And I mean, just, you know, at this point now, you can literally drive a truck over that pool deck and it's not going anywhere, but that's all thanks to an engineer, specifically to a structural engineer who knew what they were doing and came in. And, you know, you can nickel and dime that kind of stuff, but you do that at your own peril. And, you know, I certainly appreciate this industry for little things like that. I mean, nobody is ever going to know, be the wiser to that. I know that a good structural engineer had designed this and made sure that we would never have a problem with this deck. And, you know, I'm always thankful for that. And that's why I say a lot of times that even the small projects matter. So certainly, I want to, yeah, they do. And I want to encourage you to keep doing what you're doing. And the other thing I want to say to you and anybody else listening to this that's a smaller size entrepreneurial design firm, that you got to continue to fight the good fight, right? I know a lot of times it looks hopeless, or it looks like AECOM or whoever fill in the blank behemoth company is just going to swallow everything up. But not everybody wants to be part of that. And that's not to say that that's a bad thing. But the reality is that there are a lot of other options out there. And so I certainly want to encourage everybody that when you think that, oh, well, the consolidation of the industry is going to ruin it, I think that there are a lot of opportunities out there. And so what you're hearing from Scott today and what E2 is doing, even on a small scale, I think is important for us to reaffirm for everybody that there are options out there. And you should keep that in mind as you're a smaller firm, and don't just take the first offer coming, but consider how that will impact not just you and your partners, but also your employees, and then the future of what you've been trying to do. So take that for what it's worth. I don't know, Scott, if you think that's good advice or not.
Well said.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Listen, if anybody wants to reach out to you to connect with you in any way, shape, or form, be it a young engineer that's heard this and it is focusing on structural engineering and maybe is going to hang their hat up in New England, wants to come work with you guys, or just somebody that's kind of in the same boat that you're in as a peer owner, what's the best way for them to contact you?
I'd have them send an email to our info at E2Engineers.
Okay.
Email address. So right. info@E2Engineers.com.
Yep. Perfect. I'll do that. Okay. And I'll put all of your contact information in the show notes, so that way people can to reach out, connect with you on LinkedIn and connect with E2 on LinkedIn and all the other platforms that you guys are on. So we'll certainly do that and make sure that anybody that has questions about what you're doing, they'll be more than happy to reach out. So I certainly want to encourage anybody listening to this to consider doing that, and in any way that you can support Scott and his efforts. And also, I want to just say a shout out, because Scott took the time to become a best firm to work for, which speaks volumes. That does help in the recruitment process. And that's a program that Zwei Group offers through several of its programs that are all part of the Elevate AEC program, which also includes the Hot Firm Award winners. And so to be a best firm to work for, like Scott's, you know, it's not, you just need to kind of share what you guys have been doing. And it's a good way for you to do an intake and a survey with your team, because even if you don't get that award right away, you can aspire to, you know, understand what you need to do to get your company to that place where everybody feels like this is the best place in life to work. So I really want to encourage you to look into the Best Firm to Work For award. I think it's not too late at the time of recording this to apply for 2024, but you can always go to zweigroup.com to get some additional information on the Best Firm to Work For program. In the same way that Scott and his team took advantage of it, you guys can take advantage of it as well. So take that for what it's worth and try it out.
And to promote it a little bit more, it was worth it for us to do. We started doing it a few years ago just for the feedback that we got on the surveys. You know, it's all anonymous, you know, so you don't know who's answering it or saying what. I think one of the ways we improved was through the surveys. We took that information and we took it seriously. Okay, what do we need to improve on?
Right.
You know, there's a certain segment of our workforce that's not happy about this. Okay, how can we make that better? Our workforce, you know, little things that we thought were nothing. Some of our workforce was like, wow, that's great. I love these guys for doing that. That's awesome. Great. We'll keep that. We can never scrap that. So I would definitely encourage all firms, if you want to get really good optics on what your firm is and isn't, do one of these surveys, because it tells you up front what you're good at and what you're not good at.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate that. And that is a great example of why you should consider going through that. Because I think, I mean, again, you only get what you inspect, and you can inspect your organization by doing a really quality survey to really find out where your people are. And certainly if it's the type of survey where they recognize that, you know, you're not holding any one individual accountable for that survey. So it's a blind survey. It's anonymous. You can take it and it really will benefit you. It'll benefit your workplace in the long run. So I encourage everyone that's listening to this to consider it. So, well, Scott, thank you so much for joining us. today on this episode. We really, really appreciate it. I'm glad we had a chance to sit down and talk, and I certainly hope I get to meet you at some point in time in person, but we'll make sure that everybody gets to hear this episode and gets to understand what you are currently going through and working on at E2 Engineers up there in New England. And we wish you nothing but continued success. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
Absolutely. Well, folks, that's another episode of the Zweig Letter Podcast. To learn more about one of the oldest newsletters in the design industry, visit zweiggroup.com. You can read articles online, you can listen to this podcast, and sign up for a free subscription to the newsletter and have it delivered to your email inbox every Monday morning. Rain or shine, sign up today. For more information about Zweig Group's advisory services or any of Zweig Group's publications, visit zweiggroup.com. You can subscribe to the Zweig Letter Podcast wherever you listen to it. Just click the follow button on Apple Podcasts and you're all set. And please consider rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. I'm your host, Randy Wilburn, and we'll see you back here soon for another new episode of the Zweig Letter Podcast. Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to the Zweig Letter Podcast. We hope that you can be part of elevating the industry and that you can apply our advice and information to your daily professional life. For a free digital subscription to the Zweig Letter, please visit thezweigletter.com/subscribe to gain more wisdom and inspiration, in addition to information about leadership, finance, HR, and marketing your firm. Subscribe today.